sense. As the first speaker pointed out, the subject of our lecture today is victory over evil, celebrating Dasara. We find that Dasara or Vijayadashmi, Janmashtami, Deepavali, these are all the festivals which fall during the dark period, that is, during the period of Dakshinayana, where the sun moves away from the northern hemisphere, and they are all reminders to us of the light of divinity within. Vijayadashmi literally means the 10th day of victory, and it falls on the 10th day in the bright fortnight in the month of Ashwin. It is the day, of course, it's a festival associated with both war and victory, because it's the day on which Goddess Durga is supposed to have won her victory over buffalo-headed demon Mahishasura. The legend goes that once this strong and ferocious demon Mahishasura, he defeated all the gods, so much so that even Indra had to leave his heaven and go. So the gods approached Shiva, and Shiva was asked to help them. Shiva sends his wife Durga to fight this demon, and we are told that when Durga sets out for this battle, she is equipped with a special weapon by each of the gods. Shiva gives her his trident, Yama his spear, Vishnu his disc, and this shows that when you are fighting a righteous battle and when Dharma is on your side, then all the nature's forces, they come to your aid. It is also the day which is called as Dasara, or rightly Dasahara, because it is the day on which Rama won his victory over 10-headed Ravana. The 10 heads of Ravana, eternally people are wondering what they represent. Well, they could represent many things. It could be 10 vices, 10 desires. It could be 10 heads, meaning knowledge, because after all, Ravana has been a really enigmatic character. On the one hand, he is a devotee of Vishnu with lots of power and knowledge, and on the other hand, there is this viciousness. And this is exactly what these legends of war between Krishna and Kamsa, Rama and Ravana, are trying to show. In the notes on the Bhagavad Gita, we are told, commenting on the 4th chapter, that whenever the evil in the world goes on increasing and it reaches its acme, at that time then the avatar comes, because the bad karma of the people has increased so much that it produces a creature who is, as it were, the flower of wickedness. But it's not all. He is wicked, but he also has lots of knowledge. He also has magical powers to match with the adept or the being of light. But in this battle, always the being of light wins, because the general will of nature is with him. This is what is pointed out in our first quotation. It says, can a man go against the general will of nature and escape destruction, and also be able to desire wickedly with knowledge and accomplish through will what he wishes? He acquires extraordinary knowledge, enabling him to use powers for selfish purposes during immense periods of time. But at last, the insidious effects of the opposition to the general true will makes itself felt, and he is destroyed forever. This fact is the origin of those myths of combat, such as between Rama and Ravana, the demon god, and between Durga and the demons. When these wickedly desiring people threaten the stability of the world, the adherents of the good law come out in force, and the fight ensues, in which the black magicians are always destroyed, because the good adepts possess not only equal knowledge with the bad ones, but have in addition the great assistance of the general will of nature. And so it is inevitable that good should triumph, always. This assistance is also the heritage of every true student. So, this is one of the meanings of this victory over evil. There is another legend which is associated with this day, and that is lesser known legend. It's about a pupil called Kautsa, who is a pupil of sage Vartantu. And we are told that he, after finishing his studies, tells his guru to ask for Guru Dakshina. And the teacher says that I am pleased with the way in which you have completed your studies, grasped knowledge, But the pupil insists on paying his Guru Dakshina. So the Guru asks for 10,000 gold coins, Suvarna Mohar. Now, he was a poor Brahmin boy, so naturally he approaches King Raghu, who is a forefather of Rama. And as was his custom, at that point in time, Rama had already given out all his wealth distributed amongst the poor people. So he was sitting in a humble surrounding, eating out of earthenware bowl. And when the pupil approaches and puts his request, King Raghu says, "Give me 3 days' time, I will get you 10,000 gold coins." And that night when he goes to sleep, he is determined to wage a war on the Yaksha, the Devata, the one who presides over material wealth, that is Kubera. And Kubera, when he comes to know about it, he is so frightened because the prowess of King Raghu was well known. Prowess in both Astra Vidya and Sastra Vidya. So immediately he sends out a shower of gold coins on Shami tree, which was growing on the outskirts of Ayodhya. And we are told that in the morning, 10,000 gold coins were taken by the Brahmin boy. There were more, which neither the king would take, nor this boy would take, and these were then distributed amongst the people of Ayodhya. And it's in the memory of that event that today also people exchange the leaves of Shami tree, saying that take this sona, take this gold. Now this is again a victory of different kind of heroism. A king Raghu, adept king, waging war on the elemental Devata, the Kubera, and being triumphant, wanting to wage war. And on the other hand, it is also a kind of a spiritual victory of one's triumph over avarice, greed, total disinterestedness about material wealth. And so we find that we say that this is a festival where there is victory of good over evil, victory of light over darkness, victory of those who are preservers of cosmic order over those who are disruptors of cosmic order. There's always been this element of war in religious traditions, in folklore, even in Bhagavad Gita. And what are we going to make of it? This is what Sri V.P. Wadia writes in his book, Thus Have I Heard. The outer wars are but elongated shadows of the war within. The cancerous disease of thoughtlessness is eating away the eye of spirit. Involved in this tragedy, man fears and declaims about the iniquity of neighbors and kin. All the while, the trouble is within himself. He is suffering from the delirium tremens of consciousness. Having drunk to the full of selfishness, pride rules his will, egotism energizes his conduct. Like a drunk man who has lost his sense of judgment, we are drunk to the full of selfishness, pride, egotism, and lost our sense of viveka, sar asar viveka, the discrimination between good and bad. And these are the vices, selfishness, desires, egotism. These are the things we have to fight by waging a war within ourselves. It is said that it is on this festival, that is Dasara, that the Kshatriyas of old, they used to cross over their boundaries and run into each other's territories. This crossing over the boundary actually is an invitation to us also to cross over our self-created boundaries. We have, in a way, created boundaries, that is, limitations. These limitations we have imposed upon ourselves through the way in which we lived our past lives. Because each one of us is born with limited powers and faculties. There is limited physical strength, limited intellectual acumen, limited moral power. But have we ever thought that we can transcend these limitations and become like a Buddha? Have you ever thought that we can rise above that constant oscillation between pain and pleasure and experience unconditioned happiness? But we can do it because we are told that each one of us has within him infinite power, infinite potentiality. What comes in the way of expression of that power? Well, we are told that it is our mean, small, petty desires, mean, small, petty ideas, which come in the way of drawing upon that vast, illimitable source of divine energy which is within us. We give this example always, that there is outside of your house is flooded with sunlight. But what happens if you put thick cardboard against your window? No sunlight can come. If you make a small aperture in the cardboard, only that much sunlight can come. So also, to draw this divine energy, you must have pure desires and larger perspective of life. Universal ideas, because they say that behind will stands desire, and ideas, they give direction to the will. So it means we are not going to destroy desire, but we are going to make them pure. In fact, to do anything good, you must first desire it. And we are told that even Buddha, before he was born as Prince Siddhartha, in one of his earlier lives, he was only a sweeper. And when as a sweeper, he saw another Buddha, Buddha Dipankara, pass by, he was impressed with the calm and peaceful and compassionate expression on the face of that Buddha. And that life, that instant, he desired, he wished to be like him. And after that, of course, it was an effort of several lifetimes before he could become Buddha in his turn. So the beginning has to be made from where we are. And when we make a beginning, we take a stock of our, as it were, powers, faculties, who we are, where we are. What we find generally when we kind of try to take a stock, we say, oh, I go to the temple every day, I do 1 hour puja, I help people when they require help. You ask my neighbor, you ask my friends, they'll say, oh, she's a very nice, kind, generous person, helpful person. So all in all, I'm rather nice person. And if we feel we are nice people, good people, it's seldom a moment where you feel there must be a need for higher goodness. Only, as Professor C.S. Lewis says, when our natural goodness lets us down, when we have an experience which shows that this natural goodness is not enough, that we are awakened to the possibility that from nice people we have to become new men. For instance, we'll realize sometimes that it's not enough to be giving charity out of your surplus money and wealth. There may come a time when you should starve yourself in order to feed another. There may come a time when you have to deny yourself a pleasure in order to give pleasure to another. There may come a time when our eyes are opened that there is too much of what they call as mamatva, self-identifying attachment. My wife, my house, my money, my bank balance, this mamatva, this attachment must be shared. As the Ishavasya Upanishad says, Ishavasyam idam sarvam tena tyaktena bhunjitam. God is everywhere and he is to be enjoyed by renouncing. So when that detachment comes, only then in the real sense we can experience that divinity and get lasting happiness. When this realization dawns, well, that is the moment when we are effecting the transition from being nice people to being new men. And that's what we can call as living the higher life, living the spiritual life. And when we begin to live the spiritual life, we have to wage a war. Wage a war not only against our vices and weaknesses, but wage a war against even what they call as the legitimate desires. What the world calls as, well, it's quite alright to want to make money, it's quite alright to amass wealth, quite alright to get name, fame, position. All this is quite alright as far as the world is concerned. But even these we will have to get rid of. We have to wage a war against our petty theories, our wrong beliefs, our preconceptions, our likes and dislikes. And we find that when we try to do this, there is an inner conflict. There is a kind of opposition coming from within us. And this is not something which we have to really explain. Make a small resolve of taking a walk in the morning every day. And you find it will give rise to so many conflicting forces. Our habit of getting up late, our habit of reading newspaper leisurely, our habit of taking our tea leisurely, all these things will come in conflict with this single resolve of taking a walk in the morning. Now, why are we habituated like this? Now, the If you get into a deeper explanation, theosophy says that our body is made up of cells. And the cells are made up of life's tiny units of energy called elementals. And these elementals are continually being impressed with our thoughts, our feelings, our desires, our actions. And especially when we are habituated, we give repeated impressions to these lives or elementals so that they become like an army of soldiers. Like the army of soldiers who are trained by one colonel to follow a certain one set of commands and trained in one way. If the colonel of the army changes and if he gives different set of commands, wants to train them differently, these soldiers will unite and oppose. This is exactly what happens. Now this new colonel will have to efface from the minds of these soldiers the memory of the old command. He has to impress upon their minds the new commands. This is what happens when we try to change a habit, adopt a new good habit. We have to efface the impression given to all the elementals and lives in the body and give them a reverse impression. So we say that in an ordinary man, the good and the bad, it exists as a complex collective force. But the moment you make a resolve, when you take a vow, when you take a pledge, these tendencies, they separate out into good and bad. It's like two armies of Kauravas and Pandavas. And then we, making that resolve, that pledge, that sincere determination, we find ourselves in the position of Arjuna. You see, Arjuna in the Gita was also flanked on two sides with two armies of Kauravas and Pandavas. Our resolve to turn and be good is kind of a flourishing proposition for the good tendencies. But it's like a death sentence as far as the lower tendencies are concerned. So, we naturally find that there is an opposition coming. Opposition from without as well as opposition from within. Simple thing. Someone who has been in a family background where they do puja every day, where they are doing lots of rituals and ceremonies, such a person says, I want to go and study the philosophy of theosophy. And then he starts distancing himself from these rituals, these puja, prayers. There is going to be opposition from the family. Why are you going there? What will they teach you? We find you becoming Nastik. This is very small. The colleagues and friends will say, "Arey, you don't come with us on Sunday evenings for a movie. What are you getting there? You are still young. Put this away for your retirement age." So, in various ways, we are influenced. There is an opposition to, we are dissuaded from following what new discipline we are trying to take up. This is a small example, but when we really try to, in earnestness, live a spiritual life, there is an opposition coming from the society, from the family, because they don't see life as we do. And this is what, in the last quotation, in the first page, we are told in the notes on the Bhagavad Gita regarding Arjuna, and that is what is applicable to us, because each one of us is Arjuna the moment you desire to live the higher life. Every student of occultism, theosophy or true religion will go through Arjuna's experiences. Attracted by the beauty of this study, he enters upon the prosecution, application of it, and soon discovers that he arouses two sets of forces. One of them consists of all his friends and relations who do not view life as he does, who are wedded to the established order. The other opponents are far more difficult to meet because they have their camp and base of action upon the astral and other hidden planes. They are all his lower tendencies and faculties that up to this time have been in the sole service of material life. By the mere force of moral gravity, they fly to the other side. So, we have to combat the opposition from outside and also this resistance which comes from our inner lower tendencies. And in fighting these lower tendencies, in overcoming these lower desires and tendencies, we will have to go slow. Obviously, as I say, Don't eat more than you can chew. Don't try to achieve too much too soon. Because when we try to do that, and of course we can try, after all Mr. Judd said at one place that you can go through the appointed work and reach the goal in 700 lives, in 7 years or even in 7 minutes. But if you try to do it in 7 lives or 7 minutes, there is going to be a strong opposite reaction. And if you do not have the enough stamina to combat that opposite reaction, you can lose your balance, mental and psychic balance. So the advice is to go slow. There must be a continuous control, but firmly unrelaxed all along the line. The example often taken is that if someone wants to be a weightlifter, he will not straight away foolishly lift a 100 kg weight. He will go slowly. 5 kg, 10 kg, 20 kg, gradually giving training to his muscles. So also here, we have to go slow. As the Buddha in one of the chapters says, like a smith removes impurities of silver, little by little, day by day. So also we have to combat the lower nature gradually. But as we combat it gradually, we will find that probably we will succeed in overcoming the grosser vices, grosser desires. But they undergo transformation and they appear in their subtle aspects. And therefore, it will have to be a continuous fight. We will have to fight these tendencies over and over again. That's what is said in the from the voice of the silence, this quotation. The fearless warrior, his precious lifeblood oozing from his wide and gaping wounds will still attack the foe, drive from out his stronghold, vanquish him, ere he himself expires. Act then, all ye who fail and suffer, act like him, and from the stronghold of your soul, chase all your foes away. Ambition, anger, hatred, even to the shadow of desire, when even you have failed. Because it's all right. At the stage at which we are not going to steal anyone's money. If you find someone's money purse, you will want to restore it back to the owner. But if you ask yourself, what is my desire for money like? Maybe you get an answer that it's all right if you can make money by unfair means. If you are not going to be found out, I don't mind now and then making some extra bucks. That means in a subtle way the greed still lingers in me. Similarly about hatred. Maybe obviously you don't have the thought of hatred about another. But when a person comes and immediately when he speaks, you begin to dislike his speech. You don't like his mannerisms. You don't like his clothes. This is subtle form of hatred or dislike for the person. Even this needs to be overcome. We are similarly told about ambition. That ambition appears at four levels. It can become very, very subtle ambition. You help someone and you want that I must get something in return. Probably it is monetary reward that we seek for. I helped you that day, I want something. When you overcome that ambition for wealth, next you find there is ambition for fame. You help another and you want that, well, there must be public recognition or at least recognition from that person who is a very nice, kind, generous person, you know. He always helps people. Or my nameplate should be put in the hospital when I give money. If that is overcome, then there is ambition for power. I help you, but I am going to now run your life. You have to consult me. My opinion is not taken. So, from behind the scene, I want to control things. And if that is also foregone, then there is the ambition to be loved. You help another and you expect that they will at least love you for what you are doing. So, this is in a very subtle way, your ambition is transformed from one level to the other. And we are told that the greatest, as it were, the enemy to fight, they are sexual desire and the other is pride or egotism. See what Mr. Jack says. The question of sex is not the most difficult. The personal one is still harder. I mean the purely personal. that relating to me. The sexual really relates only to a low plane gratification. If nature can beat you there, then she need not try the other, and vice versa. If she fails on the personal, she may attempt the other, but then with small chance of success. That is, between the sexual desire and pride, pride is the last to go. That if you have overcome pride, then you will be tempted towards sexual desire, but you will not succumb to that. On the other hand, you may have overcome sexual desire, but nature can still trap you in your ego, in your pride, in your egotism, and that is the last core to be conquered. And we see this actually in the stories of sages and yogis. We find that a great sage, a great muni, a great rishi sits down for his tapasya, and there comes Menaka, Urvashi, some apsara or the other, a beautiful lady, and his tapasya is broken. He falls to the charm of this beautiful lady. So sexual desire still lingers. It is one of the most difficult things to overcome. And there is, last is pride. Again, we find that there is a holier than thou attitude always as you go higher. It's very difficult to check this attitude of feeling holier than the rest of the ordinary people. We find it in the sages and rishis. For example, we know the story of Vishwamitra, that for a long, long time, he remained only Raja Rishi, precisely because he was very proud. There was the great vanity in him. And it's only when he overcomes his pride that Vasishtha gives him the title of Brahma Rishi. Because of pride, he could not become a Brahma Rishi. And lastly, we also have this story of yogi who was called Changdev. And this instance is there in Gyaneshwar's life, that this Changdev had knowledge and power, but he was feeling very jealous of Gyaneshwar at the young age of 20-21. We know how he rode Gyaneshwari and himself was having knowledge and powers. Now Changdev goes to meet Gyaneshwar riding a tiger to show his power, to show maybe his superiority. And we are told that Gyaneshwar was sitting on a broken wall with his other brothers and sisters. And as this Changdev approached closer, he understood what he was trying to display. So he moved along with the wall to greet this yogi. And immediately the yogi realized his mistake. He fell at the feet of Gyaneshwar and took him as his guru. So this pride remains for a long time in a very subtle form. That's why we are told that if you have really gone to heights, do not feel proud, lest ye should fall down. Now, we find that in this conquering of our vices, we have to be vigilant so as not to make allowances for our vices. We get angry and we say, oh, but because he provoked me. We might get angry and we say, oh, I was so tired. Let it go this once. But this making of the allowance actually strengthens the envy. And that's why at one place Robert Crosby says that when a student has undertaken a discipline and he slips in the discipline, he will say, next time I will not oscillate so much. But that very thing where he says not oscillate so much, he says it shows he expects to oscillate at least a little. And if he expects to oscillate, he will oscillate. It is better to expect to hit the mark. And he says that the psychological position taken is very different. To say that I will always be calm, I will always be patient, and to say that let it happen this once, next time I'll be more patient. The psychological position is different, and so the energy which you draw from within is also in its quality very different. So this solid determination to live a particular virtue to begin with must be there. There must be no laxness. As they say in this battle, there is no quarter given or taken. A quarter is a mercy shown to the surrendering foe. And we were given the example of Prithviraj Chauhan. You know, Prithviraj Chauhan was very magnanimous. So Muhammad Ghori attacks him. And we know in the history he attacks him 7 times. But the first time he attacked, Prithviraj Chauhan defeats him. He surrenders and he says, I'll let you go. He is let, he is absolutely left scot-free. He attacks second time, the third time, and every time he allows him to go free, and the seventh time he manages to capture Prithviraj. This is what happens to our lower tendencies. If we are lax, as I think somewhere in the voice we are told, that you be careful about your thoughts, otherwise they will unite, overpower and kill you. That's a manner of speaking, but you will be overpowered by your lower tendencies if you are not vigilant and take them in your hand, take them under your control. Now in this battle, it may look like we will have to manufacture some energy from within to wage this war. Yes, it is what we call as virya or spiritual energy. But we are not going to manufacture it. It's going to be available to us the moment we surrender our personal will to the divine will. We are so assertive. Everything we want should happen in our way. We have desired this and the outcome should be so and so, it must happen. We desire something and if it doesn't happen, we begin to grumble, we begin to complain. And then, it is not really surrendering of the personal will to the divine will. In fact, we are told that in order to avail of this divine will, we have to learn to accept the woes of birth. Whatever life brings to us, we have to accept without murmur. Because these are the things which are brought on us by our own higher nature, by way of discipline and experience. There is some discipline which is going to come to us if we go through that experience without rebelling against it. There is some experience which we are going to have for better if we go through that without rebelling or murmuring. So, it is as it were something which is brought on us by the desire of our own higher nature. And if we go through it, then it is like surrendering the personal will. And then that which is within us, the divine, helps us out. And that's why in the light and the path we are told, if you fight this battle, you don't fight it. Be not thou the warrior. Let gentle yet fierce Krishna fight this battle out. Because you are finite and liable to error, he is infinite and sure. He will not allow to strike one blow amiss and so on. It just shows that therefore we have to kind of surrender ourselves, surrender the personal will rather, and allow the guidance of the divine to guide us in taking decisions regarding our moral choices and moral dilemmas. Then gradually we will find we will succeed in overcoming our lower nature. But we find that if you take Krishna for that, our higher nature, then you will also find that this higher nature is a tough taskmaster. It is not happy with partial victories. It will want 100% perfection, 100% patience, 100% calmness, 100% kindness. Till you have achieved it, it will not allow you to rest in peace. And therefore, as it is said, we are like Arjunas. Hardly was he out of one battle and he would find himself into another battle. After having undergone lots of trials and troubles and temptations, a person feels that now I can rest in peace. Now at least there will not be any more trouble. But that doesn't happen. There is, as it were, a hound from heaven chasing you towards complete perfection. And so, one after the other, trials, difficulties, troubles keep coming your way. And one by one, we need to surmount them. It's like, very humorously, Professor C.S. Lewis says, that as a boy, I used to go to my dentist. I used to dread going to him. Because not only would he pull out the tooth which was paining, but he fiddled around in my mouth and tried to find out which other tooth was now going to give me trouble. And he would like be ready to pull that out also. So whenever I went, I had to be ready for full treatment. So this is how our divine nature is. It's ready to give us full treatment. We might say, I'm happy. I'm a nice, decent chap now. Leave me alone. But once that you take a vow, a pledge, then it is seen to that you have a complete kind of perfection, all-round perfection in every way. Now we have just spoken about combating evil in our own nature. What about combating evil in the world? And as to that, we are told that one way we can combat evil in the world is by arousing public opinion, something which is done by people who are fighting against corruption. It's being done by them, writing articles, through speech, etc. But as HPB says, human laws must be reformative and not punitive. Our effort in combating evil in the world outside should be such that we will try to bring about inner conversion and inner transformation of the evildoer. There is a wonderful story in the book, Thus Have I Heard. It's called The Inner Conversion of Tojo. Tojo was the general in Japan in 1948. He was a dictator. So they try him out and he's found guilty. So he is actually sent to the gallows and executed. But before going there, we are told that a Buddhist monk preaches not only to this Tojo but to all his supporters. He teaches them about Buddhism, he teaches them about the values of life, so that finally there is an inner conversion. His total outlook on life changes completely, and we are told that he and his supporters, they go to the gallows completely serene in mind and heart, at peace with themselves and at peace with society. This was a monk who had kind of complete faith in the doctrines of Buddha regarding compassion, and he believed that the one who wants to deal with the hearts of people, he must have the inner light of compassion and peace, which can prove mightier than the darkness of sheer physical strength and might. That is exactly what he did, and in our days we know, we have this monk Thay, I think he's called Thich Nhat Hanh, I don't know how to pronounce, but he's exactly proposing the same thing. He says that these terrorists, they are the people who are not understood, so let's have open dialogues with them. You should just put these things on television, hold dialogues, try to bring them out, show them where they are and guide them in the right direction. They are people who are not understood, and therefore if you just go on punishing, they will create more terrorists. So here is an attempt to bring about inner conversion. And we know that in our life as well, probably we will not meet terrorists or robbers every day. But we find we meet people who are wicked in minor ways. There are people who are downright mean, people who are ungrateful, and we feel, oh, how disgusting. But even there, if we continue to feel goodwill, if we continue to reciprocate their evil with good, then we can, over a period of time, make them turn the corner and reciprocate our goodness with goodness. There's a little story in Eternal Verities about a little boy who goes to the hills, and whatever he shouts, there's an echo which comes back. And the boy feels that there's another boy hiding behind the hill and he's kind of shouting back. So finally tired, he says, "Go back, you bad boy." And again the voice comes, "Go back, you bad boy." Then he starts crying. He goes to his mother and says, "There is a very bad boy behind the hill and he is telling me all sorts of things." So mother says, "Never mind, you go there and say, 'Come, play with me, you good boy.'" The echo comes back, "Come, play with me, you good boy." So this is a very illustrative little story that a single good example of goodness can go a long way. After all, we know a deeper story here, that we are all united on the inner planes of our being. And if you are good, your goodness is not limited to yourself. It goes a long way in affecting others. It gets impressed in the astral light, and someone else is going to pick up your good thoughts. In fact, what we are reminded of is what Mr. Judge says, that don't think that you can't really affect others. If you want people to come to theosophy, he says, go to sleep and in the night just say silently, theosophy and help and hope for thee. And your mind will meet other minds in the vicinity and whisper into their minds, theosophy and help and hope for thee. And the result will be sudden awakening of interest. So if this can happen in this direction, similarly, our thoughts of being not greedy, our thoughts of not taking bribe, our thoughts of repaying good, evil with goodness, all these thoughts are going to affect the minds in the area, on the invisible plane in a subtle way. So this is one way of combating evil. And if we can't do anything, then we can take to heart words of Mr. Judge, who says that when you come across meanness of human nature, he says, in order to offset the terribly cold effect of perceiving the littleness of human affairs, one must inculcate in oneself a great compassion, which will include oneself also. If this is not done, contempt comes. And then the result is dry, cold, hard, repellent, and obstructive to all good work. Over a period of time, you tend to become indifferent to the world. You tend to become hard-hearted. If you don't want to be that, have enormous compassion. Have compassion even towards yourself when you tend to slip or fall. We have 7 or 8 minutes for asking questions.
During the lecture, you said that when you decide to get rid of the bad habit, we'll be vigilant, I mean, in the sense that we are, you know, assertive about it and don't make allowances. Something to the effect that the kind of will we draw from within is different than when we make allowances.
This is regarding not being lax when we slip down. And we simply quoted what Mr. Crosby says, that when you slip like this in your discipline, generally we tend to explain it away. We make allowances and say, oh, because I was tired it happened, or the circumstances were such, or it just happened, but I see to it that it doesn't happen again. It was only this once. Don't do that. Make a firmer resolve. That means we are lax even in our resolve, in our determination. So if we are firm in our determination, then he says that we don't know this. We are not able to perceive it. All this is happening inside, on the inner plane. The moment you have a strong determination, the energy that you draw from within, because after all, nothing happens without the aid of your own divine nature from within. The support keeps on coming from the inner planes of being. Just like it, the still small voice guides you. Don't go this way, go this way. So also, in sustaining our resolutions, in sustaining the good discipline which we have taken, what is it that is sustaining? We say willpower. Where does this willpower come from? From our very highest nature. And that can come when we have made this firm decision. If we are wavering, then that energy which comes tends to be scattered away. It is not focused. You see, when you have a lens, it tends to focus sunlight and creates a very clear beam, a clear image. It's something like that. When you are focused on an activity, you tend to draw. And here we say, therefore, that sometimes there are strong-willed persons in a negative way because they are so focused on making money. Like example given by Ganeshwar, that a gambler, he's so focused on his game that he forgets everything. He forgets about his hunger, his thirst, his family. He is completely focused on his game. Like that, we have to be focused on the discipline which we take. If it is precisely because we don't do that, we tend to scatter this force. We have to thoroughly imagine that I will be able to do it. It's one way. If you have had a fight with someone and you say, no, I'll go and apologize. What happens? It's all in the air. You go, you apologize, and that person says, what the hell? After having said all that, just because you apologize, you think I'm going to forgive you? And we'll be shocked and we'll come back. No, I did a wrong thing by apologizing. Did he really imagine that, no, I will apologize. If he gives me back, I will stand my ground. I will still try and still try. If we go like that, then we will succeed. Because we have thoroughly imagined. In fact, that's what a sankalpa is. Sankalpa. Kalpa means imagine and sam means thoroughly. You so thoroughly think and imagine that what you thought actually happens. So, at a highest level, sankalpa is a great power of will and desire. That the very thought arises and it translates itself into an object, into an action. But we don't do this thorough imagining, thorough thinking. And therefore, we don't draw that will which otherwise will come to our aid. So, that one pointed kind of concentration and focus on whatever we determine is very important. Probably. This is a little difficult to explain, that it is said that the sexual desire, between sexual desire and pride, which are the two most difficult enemies to conquer. And that's why we say that don't outwardly adopt celibacy, because inwardly your mind still keeps on going in that direction. So it should be from within that you have to share this attraction for the opposite sex. Let it happen from within. But between the two, Mr. Judge says that the question of sex comparatively is easy. There may come a point when you can practice celibacy totally determined from within. But the one of ego is the most difficult to overcome. And is it because the one is a more or less biological desire, whereas another one is something which is more higher at the psychological level? In fact, sex, probably you can put it as a biological drive, but the one about the ego, it goes deeper even than psychological level. We are told that it is rooted in this whole sense of separateness. It is really overcoming maya, illusion. HPP says, what is maya? It is the perceptive faculty of the ego which considers itself separate from sat. Naturally, it is the last thing to go. Overcoming maya, being able to see the presence of divinity in all, that's the last step. So, we are not just saying that you are not identified your personality, that is one step. Because this ego is also conquered. It has several strongholds. That's what Through the Gates of Gold says. It's not just feeling pride. Well, that you can overcome, you can become very humble. But when we are talking about overcoming this sense of I, we mean overcoming the sense of maya or illusion. You see the whole of manifestation as one. You have completely overcome this illusion. And I think somewhere in letters that have helped me, he says that it is vanity. That vanity is wholly tamoguna because it arises from this sense of illusion or maya. And it is very, very difficult to overcome. So, the student feels that it is in that highest sense that he says that the last thing to be fought is this sense of separateness. Because after all, we do say that first you have to dissociate yourself from your body, from your likes and dislikes, from your astral body, from your possessions, from your wealth, fame, name, etc. But even as Light on the Path says, there are desires of individual soul. There is a desire for getting knowledge for yourself. There is desire to attain to moksha. That is individual I. You are still clinging to individual I. It's only when we reach samadhi, then your I merges with and becomes universal I. And you can carry that experience in the day-to-day life when you are able to see the same divinity in the dog, in the Brahmin, in the one who eats the flesh of the dog. So, in that sense, this becomes the highest step. The step of self-realization when completely that I goes. And the beginning we make by simply getting over egotism and feeling humble, etc. But it is a subtle form, it continues to linger, the sense of I. Dansa. Thank you.